Welcome to Impossible Podcasts.
Where hinges creak in doorless chambers, where strange and frightening sounds echo through the halls, where candlelights flicker though the air is deathly still. Welcome, curious friends.
Welcome indeed. I'm PG Bell, and for those of you who are wondering, yes, that was Vincent Price. And what better co-host for this Impossible Podcast very first audio format book review? If you're a regular listener, you're probably aware that we've been posting book reviews to our blog for some time now, but we decided to stretch ourselves and finally took the plunge to podcast a book review. After all, we are Impossible Podcasts. The clue is in the title. And the subject of today's review is Quiet Houses, the brand new book from British horror author Simon Kurt Unsworth. I've been following Simon Kurt Unsworth's work since I reviewed his short story, A Place for Feeding, over at Beyond Fiction last year. I called it one of the most profoundly discomforting stories I've ever read, and it still is. So it was with some relish that I look forward to this, his first full-length work. Not that Quiet Houses is a novel in the strictest sense. Rather, it's a portmanteau piece. Now, chances are you're familiar with the portmanteau format, even if you're not familiar with the name, as I wasn't at first. Put simply, it's the ideal meld of a full-length novel and a short story collection. A series of short, interwoven tales with a central narrative to bind them all together. It's always had close associations with the horror genre. Charles Dickens used it for his collaborative collection, The Haunted House, as far back as 1859, and it really reached its peak in the 1970s with films such as Tales from the Crypt and Vault of Horror, which starred Tom Baker, incidentally. But the format has its weaknesses. In the hands of a lazy writer, the whole thing can feel disjointed and awkward, and the framing device becomes little more than an afterthought. A sort of cheap narrative sausage, stuffed with whatever scrag ends of story the author has lying around. So I'm happy to report that Quiet Houses doesn't fall into this category. In fact, Unsworth exploits the portmanteau format to full effect, weaving a multifaceted but still largely cohesive story that encompasses a variety of tones and styles. The reason it works is largely thanks to the central narrative that binds it all together. We follow Nakata, a young academic with a troubled past, as he tracks down first-hand accounts of the supernatural.
Come, let us continue our tour. There is much to see, so look alive and stay together. I'd hate to lose you so soon.
There were 158 messages when he accessed his voicemail. Most of them Nakata deleted after listening to them once, although he noted for each one the kind of message it was, wondering if there was some additional research he could gather from this about people's responses to the sort of request he had made. 71 he listed as positions, instructions or questions for him, mentioning particular buildings or places. Had he thought about the castle? The prison. He should visit the hairdressers just down the road from where the caller lived, because every time the caller went there for a haircut, they felt uncomfortable. It wasn't even that these people were wrong, he thought. It was simply that this wasn't what he was after. 29 hadn't left contact details. Anonymous. And a further 44 were nearlies. People who knew someone who'd had the kind of experience he wanted to record, but hadn't had one themselves. My grandmother had a funny experience. My mum told me there was a place. My wife said, my husband, my child, a neighbour, my friend. 11 were impressionists, people making ghostly noises, ooh, and booming hollow laughter. He looked meditatively at the columns of crosshatched lines, columns with their whimsical titles, and added them. 155. That left 3. 3 stories that might be useful, where the people had left numbers for him to call back, nervous voices saying, "I heard something," and "There's something that happened to me that might be what you're after," and "I've seen something." He noted their numbers and names, sitting at his desk with his notebook open. 3. Not a lot, but it was a start. Taking a deep breath, Nakata dialed the first number. This isn't just some cursory framing device, but a mystery story in its own right. A lot appears to be riding on the outcome of Nakata's investigation, and each individual story reveals a little bit more about his motives. His investigation is kept deliberately simple. It never gets in the way of the stories themselves, but it is intriguing enough to make us read on and discover more. Crucially, Nakata himself is an interesting character, a scientist who is not afraid to believe in the supernatural. Whereas many other writers might be tempted to wade into the tired old argument of reason versus faith, Unsworth avoids this false dichotomy and just gets on with things, trusting that we'll be sufficiently intrigued and entertained to come along for the ride. And while it's never made entirely clear just what Nakata has faith in, beyond the hope of finding the evidence he's looking for, his acceptance of the supernatural and his determination to explore the limits of his scientific worldview never get in the way of one another. This is a man who knows he will never hold all the answers. It's refreshing. So, what are the short stories themselves? Well, as I mentioned earlier, they cover a range of styles and could almost be treated as a potted history of the horror genre itself. The Elms, Morecambe, for example, is the tale of a man who claims to be haunted by a helpful ghost, which is a neat twist in itself, but that ghost is steadily ruining his life. This is subtle, understated, and more than a little reminiscent of the classic Victorian stories of M.R. James, a tone that's revisited in a later story, Beyond St. Patrick's Chapel. The Merry House, meanwhile, is a far more modern tale of something nasty lurking behind the facade of suburban life, and while it doesn't stray far from the well-worn path of such monster-in-the-dark stories, it's a path that it treads with a certain amount of flair, and there's a healthy dash of Clive Barker's hell-bound heart in the conclusion. The only place in which I felt the balance tipped a little too far in one direction was probably The Ocean Grand, the tale of a haunted hotel, which seemed to have little impact on the ongoing investigation. But the story was interesting enough that that hardly mattered.
As you travel past these priceless works of art, perhaps you sense a disquieting metamorphosis. Of course, it's only a trick of the light. The real beauty of this house awaits us farther on.
Mandeville couldn't sleep. It was partly that his camp bed was uncomfortable, and that both Parry and Yeoman snored, but it was also excitement. The Grand was the most important job the crew had ever taken on, and it could make their reputation. Most of their earlier work had been in helping homeowners discover the histories of the buildings they lived in, and to carry out refits and rebuilds taking this history into account, but the Grand was a step into the next league. The art alone, even if only a part of it could be rescued, would add to their understanding of how art had changed and grown in the early years of the century, and the building itself was, in design and construction, almost unique, and certainly one of the few surviving examples of its type. Restless, he walked through to the sun corridor, but could see little through the glass. He heard the sound of the ocean crouched in the darkness, muted and elastic like the breathing of some huge animal at rest. It was cold, and he pulled his coat tightly around him, watching as his breath misted on the glass in front of him, bleeding to odd colours because of the thin coating of paint smeared across the inside of the panes. "I forgot to ask Parry about that," he thought briefly, and made a mental note to do so before they started work tomorrow. When he played the narrow beam of his penlight across the pane, the smears of paint were clearer than they had been in daylight. For a moment, he couldn't tell what the smears reminded him of, and then it came to him. It looked as though the windows were covered in hundreds of handprints. When it does finally come time to reveal some of the truths behind Nakata's quest, Unsworth chooses to tread a very fine and tricky line between supernatural terror and the scientific process. I won't give too much away here, but Nakata's story is not so much rooted in resolving hauntings as it is in establishing them. It's a clever twist on the well-worn trope of paranormal investigation, but it doesn't make life easy for Unsworth. Shining the unforgiving light of scientific method into the murky corners of supernatural horror means that he's only ever one step away from undermining its power to terrify. After all, ghosts and things that go bump in the night are scary precisely because they are unknown. As soon as they're quantified and understood, they all too often lose their edge. It's a persistent problem in the horror genre, so it's a testament to Unsworth's writing that, on the whole, he pulls it off. Despite the fact that we're taken through the process of a controlled haunting from beginning to end, he still achieves a mounting sense of disquiet and tension that finally spills over into outright chills. I enjoyed it, and it's just a shame that the resolution doesn't quite do the whole sequence justice. After all that tension and suspense, it's all over quite quickly, and in a fairly straightforward, if suitably dramatic, fashion. The revelation of Nakata's backstory is just one half of the book's finale, though. The climax of his investigation leans far more heavily on unanswered questions and the unknown. And hey, any book that features ghostly killer cows must be doing something right. So there we have it. Quiet Houses is a thoughtful book that's often creepy, sometimes shocking, and packed with enough variety to keep even the most jaded of horror readers interested. And it moves at a fair old pace as well. I recommend it. The book will be officially launched by its publisher, Dark Continents Publishing, at FantasyCon 2011 in Brighton, on Saturday the 1st of October. Simon Kurt Unsworth will be in attendance, and so will I. And he's agreed to give us an interview, so check back soon if you want to hear from the man himself. Until then, thank you very much for listening. As I said at the start of this podcast, this review has been a bit of an experiment, so we'd really like to hear your thoughts on the whole subject. Would you like to hear more reviews of books, games, and TV in podcast form, or are you happy with the written word? Get in touch and let us know. Until next time, bye-bye.
I leave you now, but I'll be waiting for you on the other side. Have a frightfully good time.